Hi, everybody. My name's Danny, and I'm a cocaine addict. Is that okay? Oh, okay. You know, isn't the countdown great? I have to refrain from getting carried away with that, though, because one time I was speaking somewhere, and I got all into it, and I'm yelling and screaming, and then I had to come up to the podium to share, and I had no voice left. So I just kind of clap now, but I love it, though. It's a great deal. Before I forget, I want to thank the committee for asking me to come up. It's always an honor and a privilege to do so. So I appreciate that. Thank you. And everybody up here that worked on the committee, thanks. Before I start, a lot of you people have heard me before, but I'm glad to see that there was, matter of fact, that table there could probably tell my story. But I'm glad to see there's a lot of new people here tonight. And welcome. Welcome. Buckle yourself in. I think Jim said, you're in for a hell of a ride. Before I start, I like to loosen up and joke around a little bit, so I do a little show and tell with you, something I found some years ago. And this is, because there was a lot of signs that I had a problem with alcohol and drugs, and I never paid any attention to them, and I should have, and there was a lot of them. And so I found this thing some years ago, and I love to share with people. I'm going to hold it up. I don't know how many people back there can see it, but it's a picture of an old lady, you see, and it says on the top, before six beers, okay? And then you take the same picture and just turn it upside down, and it becomes a picture of a princess, and it says, after six beers, so. I'm sure some of you guys can relate. If you ever went to bed with Cindy Crawford and woke up in the morning with Lassie, you know, that's a problem that maybe you had a problem with alcohol, you know. And there's signs along the way that I should have paid heed to that I had a problem with cocaine. You know, if the grocery delivery man is at your door again with chore boy and baking soda, that's a sign that maybe I'm doing too much cocaine. You know? If the voices in your head are grinding their teeth, that's a... that's a sign that maybe you're doing too much cocaine, I don't know. I always like to joke around just to loosen up, you know. What I share with you people is what I always share. For those of you that heard me once, twice, five times, you know, what it was like and what happened don't change. You know, hopefully you stick around and what changes is what it's like today, you know. And I'm one of these people that come up here and I talk about the insanity of cocaine. And especially tonight, I want to do that because I see so many of the new people here, and hopefully maybe you could relate to something, you know, because we clean up really good. We get sober, and, you know, we put a suit on, and the ladies look beautiful tonight, and sometimes the new people think, well, you know, you ain't been where I just came from, you know. And so before I even get started tonight, let me share with you my analogy of cocaine. So... maybe right off the rip we can relate. Cocaine was like the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life. In a nightclub with 1,500 people in the place, on the other end of the club, my lady Cocaine. And I see her and I gotta have her. And I make my way through the crowd, through all the obstacles in my life, and I get up to her and I get lucky and I get to leave there with her. And we jump in a cab and all the way in the cab ride back to her place, I got this thing going on in my stomach, just anticipating how good it's gonna be. You know, it's so powerful, it's right here choking me. You know, it's so strong, even my butt is puckering. Just thinking about it. And we get up and we go to her apartment and we go to bed, and just like I knew it was the best lovemaking I ever had in my life. And when it's over, I get up to go to the bathroom and she reaches under bed and grabs a bat and pow, cracks my head open. Takes all my money and all my dope and all my jewelry. And about 20 minutes later, I start coming to and I stagger to my feet and I'm dizzy and I'm hurting. and I'm bleeding. And the first thing I say is, where is she? I gotta find her. I know she didn't mean that. I know she loves me. When I find her this time, it's gonna be different. Now, if you can relate to that, then you're definitely in the right place tonight. That's my analogy of what cocaine was with me. So anyway, let me start like I usually do. I always talk about four things when I have the opportunity, and I've been blessed many times to come up to the podium and share. And I always share about the same four things. I acknowledge four things that are important in my life today, and the first is God. And I don't make no bones about talking about God. I have a loving, loving God in my life today. And the second thing that I acknowledge that I understand I have in my life today is miracles. I really believe in miracles. And I'm a miracle. And I don't know most of you people in the room, but I bet you just about everybody here is a miracle. You know. And the third thing that I like to acknowledge and that I believe in and it's in my life today is I believe in angels. And I believe that all around us right now, we're surrounded by angels. They're all over the place right here. The fourth thing that I believe in is the reason that I believe in the first three. And that's Cocaine Anonymous. If it weren't for Cocaine Anonymous, I would not know nothing about God. I wouldn't know that I'm a miracle. And I wouldn't be in touch with the angels that are all around us. So I always acknowledge those things. Cocaine Anonymous put me in touch with all those things. And I like to talk about that. I think as I share with you my story, what it was like and what happened, what it's like for me today, that I'll talk to you about God, I'll talk to you about miracles and angels, and certainly the whole thing is to do with Cocaine Anonymous. So I want to tell you, I don't come from a dysfunctional family in the sense that my mother wasn't an alcoholic or an addict, and my father wasn't an alcoholic or an addict, But I know that there was something wrong with me all my life. Way before I ever had a drink or a drug, way before I ever smoked a joint, there was that, the book talks about that strange mental twist to our thinking. I had that all my life. You know, and as far as I can remember, and I go back and I'll share with you about my earliest memories, about 5 years old, I guess. And I'm born and raised in New York City in a little neighborhood we call Little Italy. And in my neighborhood, growing up in the early 60s in my neighborhood, to me, the greatest thing in my life was the New York Yankees. One of the greatest things in my life today is the New York Yankees. So I was a little kid, maybe like 5 years old, and I had all the baseball cards from the Yankees that year, except for one. I didn't have Roger Maris. And there was another kid in my neighborhood. He had all the cards, but he didn't have Yogi Berra. So he said to me one day, "You want to flip?" And I said, "Sure." So we made an appointment to meet the next day. And I went home and I practiced flipping all day with my Yogi Berra card. And all I thought about was tomorrow I'm going to have the whole Yankee team. 5 years old, the greatest joy in my life. It never crossed my mind that I might lose my Yogi Berra card. And the next day we met in the park and we flipped and he won. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me that not only am I not going to get Roger Maris, I'm about to lose Yogi Berra. And I got this thing, this anxiety in me went up, and it was just choking me. It was just a terrible thing, and I just couldn't let that happen. I kicked his ass. And I took all his cards from him. You know, and I learned an important lesson that day. I learned a lesson that stuck with me for 20-something years. I learned that if I can't get what I want the right way, I just kick some ass and take it. Worked for me. And about a year late, I was maybe about 6 years old, in my neighborhood we had the feast, which is an Italian festival. And what they do at feast time is they come in and they block the streets off and they put games and food carts in the streets and everybody for 10 days pigs out and has fun. And I was like 6 years old, and I had a quarter in those days, and a quarter you could buy a whole bag of candy. And I went down to the cotton candy stand, and I got a thing of cotton candy, and I ate it all. It was good. I liked it, so I wanted some more. And I got like two things of cotton candy for the quarter. And I had three brothers. One of my brothers had safe, you know, the kind you take a butter knife and pop it open. Cracking my brother's safe. I get it open, and I take out a half a buck, and I go back down to the feast, more cotton candy. It was good. I liked it, and I ate it all. I ate the whole 50 cent up worth of cotton candy. It was good. I liked it. I wanted more. I didn't have no more money, so I went back up to the apartment. I went to my mother's purse, and I took a dollar. And I went back down to the feast, and I got cotton candy. And now I'm eating the cotton candy, and all of a sudden, I started getting paranoid. I'm thinking there's thousands of people all around me. Somebody's going to say, hey, where are you getting all this money for this cotton candy? So I went into the alleyway between two buildings, and I'm crouching down, and I'm eating the cotton candy. One night when I was going to see somebody in a building, I crouched in the alleyway one night, different alleyway, same neighborhood, and I took the pipe out and I hit the pipe. And you know what? The tendencies were all the same, you know? I never stopped and thought about what I'm doing, and I lived my life for 20-something years that just, it didn't matter who I had to do what to. If I wanted something, I went and took it. You know, I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I don't come from a dysfunctional family. I actually grew up in a family who came from a lot of love. I come from a big Italian family, and there was a lot of love in my house growing up. And my father was a big man. He was a handsome man. He used to pick me up. He used to take me in his arms. He used to say, I love you, Danny. And I said, I love you too, Dad. And so I share this with you because I want you to know there was a time in my life that I felt at peace with myself and one with the world. I never said, Danny, you're at peace with yourself and one with the world, but I had no fears, no worries, no anxieties. Life was good. I couldn't wait every day to wake up and get out and hit the world because life was good for me. And my father used to pick me up and hug me and say, I love you, Danny. And I said, I love you too, Dad. And my mother was a beautiful woman. She used to take me to her bosom. She said, I love you, Danny. And I said, I love you too, Ma. Life was good. My grandmother didn't speak much English. She used to hug me and say, Benassar, Danny, Benassar. I said, Benassar, Noni. Life was good for me. And that's just the way it was. And I remember that time. And one night, I had three brothers, and we used to sleep in the same room. And one night, it was late at night, and my brothers were sleeping, and I couldn't sleep this night. And I was tossing and turning, and there was a knock at the door. And I kind of went out to the hallway, and my mother went to the door. She opened the door. There was a policeman there. And he was there to tell that there was a shootout and my father was dead. And I was listening, and I didn't understand what that meant because I had never dealt with death before. I was 10 years old. And in about a half an hour, my place was full of people. And the men were in one corner whispering, the women were in another corner crying. And I went in and I said, what's going on? And one of my uncles says, your dad's dead, Danny. And I says, well, what does that mean? And they said, that means he's not coming back no more. You know, and I didn't know it then, and I didn't know it for a long time until a couple of years in this program, but I could tell you for sure today that that was the dividing line in my life, that that was the point in my life that I wasn't okay with myself, at peace with myself and one with the world anymore. And that was the very day that I started building walls in my life to keep you out. And I don't know what your shit is, but I could tell you that something that was affected me all my life and even early in sobriety here was that I didn't know how to allow you to love me. Because ever since that day, my mother would hug me and she'd say, I love you, Danny. And I'd say, I love you too, Ma, on the outside. But on the inside, I'd say, uh-huh. And my grandmother would hug me and she'd say, Benassar, Danny. I'd say, Benassar, Noni. I love you too, Grandma, on the outside. But on the inside, nah. And I've been fortunate all my life, and I've been fortunate that I've had women in my life that want to love me and be part of my life, and they'd say, I love you, Danny, and I'd say, I love you too, baby, on the outside. But on the inside, I'd be saying, oh, we ain't going there. Can't do that. And a couple of years sober, I became aware of that that was my problem, that was the big thing for me. And I've been working on that for years, and I've made lots of progress in that area. You know, and today I believe I have the ability to allow somebody to love me. You know, we all come in here with our different things, you know. The book talks about, we find out cocaine is just a symptom to our problems. And we put the cocaine and the alcohol down, we find there's a whole lot wrong with us, of which a whole lot has to be done, Bill says. You know. So, I was 12 years old and the police brought me home. And I was running the streets and getting in trouble. And 13 years old, I got 6 months in reform school. They locked me up in a cell. And 14 years old, they gave me 18 months in a reform school. So by the time I was 16, I was locked in a cell for 2 years already. And when I turned 17 years old, I got in trouble, and they were going to lock me up. My mother was dying of cancer, and she went to, they were going to charge me as an adult, and she went to the judge and begged the judge not to lock me up. And the judge, I stood in front of the judge, 17 years old, and he said, you could go to prison for 3 years or you could join the service. So I said, where do you sign up? You know, and I want to tell you that. I'm one of these people that talked about, I used to say this all the time, I ain't hurting nobody but myself. You know, and I believed that for so long. I say, you know, what I'm doing ain't hurting nobody but me, so thank you. I want to tell you how foolish that is. That when my mother died in 1976, I read her diary, and I read how it was killing her. That at 13 years old, I was locked up, and she couldn't do nothing. At 14 years old, I was locked, and it was just tearing her life apart, you know. But we don't hurt nobody but ourselves, you know. What happened was I went in the Army, and I went to the Army for 3 years, and I wound up doing 2 years in the Army and 6 years in the brig, and I got a dishonorable discharge because the Army don't play that either, you know? And I was wild, man. And while I was in the Army, I got a girlfriend from my neighborhood, childhood girlfriend. She got pregnant, and we got married. And by the time I was 19 years old, I was married. I had two kids. And, man, I come out of the Army, and I just started running around doing stuff. And, you know, it wasn't long before I caught a long prison sentence. And I went away for 15 years and did 6.5 behind the wall on that. You know, and I didn't have one sober day in 6.5 years. And I never thought there was anything wrong with that. I used to get high every day in the joint, you know, and I just never even thought there was anything wrong with me being away. You know, my kids were this big when I went away, and they were this big when I got out. And I just thought it was like occupational hazard, you know. Like if you're a carpenter, you might bang your finger one day, you know. For me, I was making my living on the street, and I got caught, and I had to go away. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that, you know. And so I came out, and the reason I share all this, which is to tell you my mind frame, you know, we all have our stories, and we all come from different points, but we all wind up here. And every one of us sitting in this room tonight is useful to somebody else. And I don't know who I'm talking to tonight, but I know I'm talking to at least one person tonight. And I don't know who that one person is. But I know at least one person tonight is going to hear me, is going to relate to me, is going to feel me. And whoever that person is tonight, be it man or woman, that's what I'm talking to tonight. Because somebody has felt what I felt and gone through the things that I've gone through that's sitting in this room tonight. And that's what it's about. So I share these things with you. You know, I came out of prison, and I'm still running around and just doing insane things, you know. And cocaine, when I started doing cocaine, so I'm one of these 60s, early 70s kids, and, you know, so we did all the kind of drugs there were, you know, and there were a lot of good drugs in those days, and, you know, four-finger lids, nickel bags, you know. But, yeah, good as weed. But when I started doing cocaine, it was a very... It was a very kind of a luxury kind of drug, you know. I can remember starting doing cocaine. We'd take a limo to the Hilton and get high all weekend, you know. And then a couple of years later, it was like we're taking a cab to the Days Inn, you know. A couple of years after that, it was like walking to this hotel that, I don't know, it was black. It said no trespassing, and, you know, there was no electricity on there. And, you know, and that's the degradation of cocaine, but it was a very luxury kind of thing, you know. And I loved everything about it. And I want to tell you that I'm not standing here tonight because I hate cocaine. I'm here tonight because I love that shit. I love everything about it. I love dealing with all the lowlifes. I love the anticipation and the waiting and the bullshit, and I love the strawberries, and I love everything that goes with it. I said that in England when I was sharing in England, and somebody came up to me and said, "Well, what's a strawberry?" So, strawberries, the hookers you have to deal with. She's coming, you know, and the women that are smoking too, and that kind of stuff. But and I love all that. You know, I'm not here because I hate cocaine. I'm here because I love it. How can I stand here tonight and tell you I hate that shit? What I can't stand. I can't stand coming down. God, what a terrible feeling that was every time I came down. So that's the thing that I hated about it. I always wound up busted and disgusted. Never suicidal, but I always got homicidal. And I didn't want to hurt me, but I should have killed you. And I never, and I have never in my entire sobriety come close to feeling anything like I felt every time I came down off of cocaine. That horrible feeling. Oh, just terrible. But I want to tell you, the insanity of this disease is really simple for me. It's no great philosophy on the insanity of this disease is I can't stop doing it. I don't want to. I swear I ain't gonna do it no more, but I can't stop. And towards the end, it got so bad for me that I started doing things that, you know, my last 5 years before I got sober, I knew I couldn't do no more cocaine and I knew I couldn't stop. And that's a terrible, vicious cycle to be stuck in. Cocaine is the greatest solvent I ever seen. It will remove everything from your life. So, and I am watching everything slip away from me, and I just could not stop. I didn't want to. You know, it just got so bad. I would go out, and after 3 days, I'd have no money left, but I didn't want to go home because I knew the wife was up. And so I'd wait around till about 1 in the morning, and then I'd tiptoe in the house, and she'd be sleeping, and I didn't even want to get undressed. I'd just kick my shoes off, and I'd get in bed real easy-like, and I'd take a deep breath and freeze because I didn't want to wake her up. And I'd lay there, and I'd cling to this stupid thought that maybe when I wake up in the morning, all that money I spent is going to be under my pillow. And my wife would say, "Honey, you're home. I've missed you." And the kids would run and jump on my lap, say, "Daddy, Daddy, we love you." And I'd just lay there, trying not to move, not to breathe. And I'd just, sometime during the night, I'd just fall off. And sometime the next day, I'd come to, and I'd look under the pillow, and there'd be nothing there. And I'd get up, and I'd walk in the kitchen, and she'd be in the kitchen, and she'd look at me, and she'd say, "You son of a bitch, you did it again." And I'd been out for 3 days, and I needed a shave, and my eyes were sunken in, and my cheeks were sunken in, and I smelled, and I looked like death warmed over. The kids would hear my voice, they'd run into the kitchen, they'd see me, they'd run back into their room. And I'd go to the bathroom, and I'd look at myself in the mirror, and I'd say, "What's the matter with you, Danny? Why can't you stop?" And then I'd say, with every fiber of my being, I'd say, "I swear to God, I ain't going to do this no more." And I'd mean it. And I want to tell you that every time I said that, I meant that just as sure as I'm standing here tonight. I just didn't know that that wasn't enough. I thought because I meant it so much that that's all I needed. And I took that thinking into recovery, and I thought when I got sober, because I want this so bad, that's good enough. And I want to tell you, if you're new, you got to get willing. Wanting to be sober is not willing. I got to do some things because I could not stop. It got so bad, I can remember getting some dope and going up to the apartment with my friend, and we sit on the couch, and as I hit the pipe, I say, "Check the window, there's somebody at the window." What are they, hovering with wings out there? And I'd pass him the pipe, he'd take a hit, and he'd say, "They're at the window." It was insane. It was insane. When I think about the things that I did on every time I got high, it was like insane. Getting on the floor, you know, my first time, it was like kind of just reaching down and just touching the floor, you know. You know, it's just terrible. I'm telling you. These are not wrinkles on my face. These are Venetian blind marks. Just crazy. And I can remember one time towards the end of my using that, I said to myself, myself one day. I said, Danny, you're doing too much cocaine. Don't do no cocaine tonight. And this is, I'll back up in a minute, but my wife had left me already. And so I called this lady up. I got dressed up. I put a suit on. I jumped the cab. We went to the restaurant, and we're sitting down, and we're eating dinner. And it's raining really hard this night. And the whole time we're having dinner, the cocaine's calling me. Cocaine's going, Danny. And I'm going, huh? Back up to my apartment, and I said, sit down, baby, I'll be right out. And I went into the bathroom. I got my dope down. I went to the bathroom. Now, you got to remember, this lady didn't even drink or nothing. She sat on the couch and watched me go into the bathroom. And I step into the shower, and I don't know why. I got my suit on, you know. And I hit the pipe. And I'm in the bedroom maybe 20, 30 minutes. I'm sweating like a bastard. And after about 30 minutes, I open the bedroom door. And I'm holding my pants because they're making too much noise. And I tiptoe right by her like she's not even there, right? I kind of do the combat crawl to the window. To the window, and I remember it was raining really hard. I get to the window, I peek out the window, and the lightning struck just as I peeked out the window. And I said, oh shit, they just took my picture. Don't forget, I'm on the 9th floor, right? And she got up and ran at it. To her was like Dr. Jekyll went in the bathroom and Mr. Hyde came out. She got, you know what I did when she ran out of there? And I went to the door and I bolted it up. I said, thank God she's gone. She was fucking my head up. The insanity of this disease is I can't stop. I don't want to. I swear I'm not gonna. But there I am doing it all over again the next day. It's insane. I know, I laugh. I think about it today, and what I could have done would have been just about the same thing, is I could have went to, like, the middle of the South Bronx, like, 2 o'clock in the morning, where there's, like, a whole bunch of guys hanging on the corner, and I could have took $5,000, and I said, hey, kick my ass, and you can have this. You know, and then when they beat me and stomp me down and kick me and step on me and take my money, and as they're walking off, I go, hey, I'll see you tomorrow. Right? What's the difference? The difference really is this. Nobody ever abused me the way I abused me. If anybody ever tried to abuse me that much the way I abused me, I would have killed them and chopped them up. Nobody done to me like I done to me. Unbelievable. Anyway, let me tell you. I tell you what happened when I came out of the... When I came out of prison, I'm back in my neighborhood, and man, I was there was another case. I was home for a couple of years, and I caught another case, and there was five of us on trial, and there were 7 charges, and 2 charges were 15 years, and the other 5 charges were life without parole for all of us. And so I tried to make a deal with the DA to cop out. I was willing to take 10 years, and the DA wasn't making no deals. He had a good case on all of us, and he wasn't nobody was able to cop out. And so, in those days, I had what I call my 7-Eleven God. It was a convenience store kind of God. You know, I went there when I needed something. And I went to God, and I made this deal with God. God, if you get me out of this one, I'm going to be a good husband, a good father, a good brother, a decent human being. And I meant that, you know. And so I go, and we're on trial for like 3.5 months. And after 3.5 months, the jury came out, and the 5 of us stood up in all 7 charges. Not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. Right down the line, all of us. And I pumped my chest out, and I looked at the DA, and I laughed at him. He said, you asshole, you had me for 10 years, and now I'm walking out of here. And I went home, and I forgot all about God, if you help me. I forgot all about, I thought I was God at that point. You couldn't touch me then. And I walked out of there and I went home and I kissed the wife and I hugged the kids and I pet the dog and I got the pipe down. And I proceeded to go on a 2-year binge. And about a year into that 2-year binge, my wife, who had been with me for 17 years, came up to me and she said, you're killing yourself and everybody around you, and I can't take no more, Danny, I'm out of here. And I want to tell you where my mind was in those days. I went, see, you're leaving me? Something wrong with her. Like I was a bargain, right? And so go ahead. And I had some friends of mine from the neighborhood that were down in Florida. And they were doing some things. And they kept telling me, come to Florida. We're making money down here. And I wasn't trying not to use it or not. And I just figured a geographic would be okay, you know. So I was going from New York to Florida, New York to Florida, back and forth. And I had my eye on this restaurant down there. And in my neighborhood, I tell you, I come from Little Italy. And what happens even today, in today's times, people come from Europe, from Italy, and they come, they move right to my neighborhood. And that's why, one of the reasons we call it Little Italy. And there was a family that just moved to my neighborhood. And the guy's name was Luigi, and he had a wife and two kids. And I wanted this restaurant down in Florida, so I said to him, Luigi, come with me to Florida. We'll take this restaurant, we'll put it in your name. I don't want to do any work. You just give me an envelope every week. And he said, Danny, all I want is for my kids to grow up in America. And I said, you know, I had a part to play in those days. I used to play good. I said, Luigi, don't worry about nothing. You stay with me, not only will your kids grow up in America, they'll be rich. And I packed this man and his family up and we took him down to Florida and we bought this restaurant. And I got myself a nice condo on the second floor of this development. And he opened this restaurant. He was a good, honest, hardworking man. And the restaurant started doing good. And all I was doing at this point was smoking. I was just smoking. And I didn't want to know nothing or nobody. And I was just, I'd smoke till I passed out. And I'd come to and I'd start smoking again. I just lived for the next hit. And anybody in my life, my children, my family, anybody in my life that meant anything to me, I just kicked everybody to the curb for another hit of dope. And I was meeting this Colombian guy, and I met this Colombian guy at the restaurant one day, and I got a kilo of coke. Because every once in a while, I used to get a kilo, and sometimes I'd make it to New York and sell half of it, and most of the times I wouldn't. But so I met this Colombian guy at the restaurant, and he gave me a kilo, and I went into the office of the restaurant. They had these drop ceilings. And I broke a big piece off of this thing, about 200 grams. And I took the rest and I pushed it up in the ceiling. And I went home to my condo. And I knew I was going to be getting high for like 3 days. So I wanted to eat something. So I took this leather bag and I put my scale in there, the Dering, and all my paraphernalia and the coke. And then I did something I never did in my life before. So I talk about the angels, right? See, I believe that the angels have been with me all my life. I believe that God's been protecting me and watching over me all my life. What I believe today is that God loves me just as I am, no matter how I am. And I'll get to that in a minute, though. But what happened was I took my gun and I put it in the bag, too. And I was schooled all my life, don't ever give anybody your gun, because the biggest insult in the world is to get shot with your own gun. But for some reason, I put my pistol in there, too. I zipped the bag up. I went downstairs to the guy under me. I said, hold this for me. I'm going to eat something, and then I'll take care of you. He said, sure, Dan. And I went back upstairs, and I started making myself something to eat. And the DEA came over. They were watching this Colombian guy. And they went through my apartment and tore my apartment up, and there was nothing there. Usually they find a pistol, they bring me in for the pistol. There was nothing there. They took me down to Miami. They had Luigi in one room, and they had me in the other room, and the agent says to me, we found a kilo of cocaine in your restaurant. And me being a stand-up guy I am, I said, I don't own a restaurant. And the agent said to me, we know that's your restaurant. And I said, look, pal, if you found something in a restaurant, you need to talk to somebody else, because I don't own a restaurant. And make a long story short, after a couple hours, my lawyer came, and they had to let me go. But they weren't letting Luigi go. The restaurant was in his name. He wasn't a citizen. He had a green card. And they were charging him with a dope. And you know, and here's a man that wound up doing a year in jail, being deported. His family went with him. His whole great American dream shattered by me, because what I'm doing ain't hurting nobody but myself. You know? And that's just one of the lives that have been ruined in my tornado. And that's not even one of the worst stories. You know? So. And what happened was, I left that agency down there, and I went back to my condo, and I didn't want to feel anything. And all I wanted to do was escape. And I knocked on that guy's door. I said, give me that bag back. And I went upstairs, and I started cooking stuff up so big that it was melting down the sides. I just wanted to escape. The phone was ringing. It was Luigi's wife. I didn't want to answer. There was nothing I could do for him. You know, and I just didn't want to feel. And for the next 3 days, and this is really nothing out of the ordinary, but for the next 3 days, all I ate for 3 days was about 15 packs of cigarettes, 3 or 4 bottles of vodka, and a whole lot of cocaine. And after the first day, I'm so paranoid because I'm thinking Luigi's going to give me up and any minute they're going to come back and get me. And I'm extra paranoid, you know. And I made a decision. And a big book talks about we made many resolutions but never a decision. I made a decision. The decision I made was when they come back, they ain't taking me in. And that we're going to hold court right there, and I'm going to be the judge and the jury and the executioner, and somebody's dying with me, but they ain't taking me in. I'm too messed up, and I ain't going to jail. And I'm there, and I'm just smoking, and I just don't want to feel or know nothing. You know, and at this point, I kicked everybody out of my life. We're coming into the night of the third day, and the crickets from doing their little crickety noise that they make, you know. I had been living down here for about a year now in Florida, and I heard that noise every night. But on that particular night, I didn't hear it to be the crickets. What I heard it to be was the crackling of the police radios. And I knew I was surrounded. And so what I was doing, I was in the middle of my living room floor, and I'd hit the pipe, and I'd put the pipe down, and I'd take the pistol, and I'd crawl out to the terrace, and I'd look around to see where they were, because I know I'm surrounded. It's the crickets, right? Well, I'm trying to find where they're hiding, the cops. And then I'd crawl back in, and I'd put the pistol down, I'd hit the pipe, and I'd put the pipe down, I'd grab the pistol, and I'd crawl back out, and I'd look, and I'd come back. And that's what I did for hours. I crawl out with the pistol, crawl back in, put the pistol down, hit the pipe, put the pipe down, get the pistol. And, you know, I had the pistol in one hand, pipe in the other hand, not knowing which one to suck on next. And I'm crawling in and out, and I'm, you know, just bug-eyed crazy. And then I heard these words. I heard somebody say, "Okay, Sarge, let's go." That was it. I got to my feet for the first time in, like, hours. And I put the pipe down nice and easy, and I grabbed the pistol. And what I'm sharing with you now happened this quick, all that quick. And I ran to the terrace, and I reached down, and I reached over, and I looked down, and there was one guy down there. And I said to myself, "One guy for me? Don't they know who I think I am?" And in that fraction of a second that I hesitated, he said it again, the guy. He said, "Okay, Sarge, let's go." And his dog came. He was calling his dog. And the man never looked up. I was on top of him. He was down right below. He never looked up. He never saw the bug-eyed crazy man on top of him. He don't know to this day that he came this close to dying. I was about to shoot him on the head. I wonder one day, because I don't know who he is, I wonder one day I might be in a meeting and somebody might come up to me and say, "Hey, I lived in Florida. I had a dog named Sarge." I don't know. Maybe I could make amends to the guy. You know, I don't know. But he don't know. And I realized, I had a little moment of clarity, and I realized that I was gone, way, way beyond control. My whole body was shaking, and I pulled my arm back in, and I walked back into the apartment, and I don't know how I did what I did, except to tell you, the angels came and helped me. Because I picked that 200-pound phone up, and I called New York, and I called my brother, and I said, "I'm dying down here, man. I need some help." And I want to share with you what kind of miracle that was in itself. Because, see, up to that point in my life, I had been a tough guy all my life. I made a living on hurting people. And for me to ask for help was something that I couldn't do. So I know the angels came and touched me that night. I know that God came down and sent the angels down to help me. And my brother said, "Take it easy, man. Let me make some calls." And when he called me back, he said, "I'm taking the red eye. I'll be there first thing in the morning. We're going to put you in the hospital up here in New York." And I said, "Cool," and I hung up the phone with him. And I hear people come to the podium. When you come to the podium, I believe anything you say up here. And I hear people come up here and talk about, "I hate cocaine, I don't ever see it no more. I threw it away, I flushed it in the toilet, I put it down the sink." That's not my experience. I hung up the phone with my brother. I got about 100 grams left. He's coming in the morning, I'm trying to smoke it up. I'm smoking, I ain't throwing shit away. I'm smoking and smoking, and my brother gets there the next morning, and we drive to the airport, and I'm smoking, and we get on the airplane, and we get 30,000 feet up in the airplane, and I go to the bathroom on my fourth day up, and I take the pipe out, and I hit the pipe, and I'm stuck in the bathroom in the airplane. I can't come out of the bathroom. I know that if I open the bathroom door, and the plane's going to go, They're waiting for me to come out so they can look at me. I'm in the bathroom so long, the stewardess was knocking on the door. You okay? So I'm going, I don't feel good. 4 days up, I'm in the bathroom. I can't even breathe anymore. I'm holding the smoke in, not to exhale. And we land in LaGuardia Airport, and I get off the plane, and we drive into Manhattan, and I'm smoking all the way. Then my brother pulls in front of this hospital in Manhattan on the Upper East Side, and I say, go around the block, man. I got some more shit left. And he goes around the block a couple of times, and he pulls back in front of the hospital, and he says, you're not going to be able to finish that, man. You're going to have to go in. And I said, I can't go in now. I'm too fucked up. Take me home. And I forgot about all that pain and all that suffering, and I just didn't want to, you know, I was on my fifth wind, and I don't know how I could tell you that I got out of that car and went to that hospital, except to tell you that the angels came, and they put their arms on me, and they helped me out of that car. And I crawled into that hospital, and that was November 21st, 1991. And I want to let you know also, these new people that are here tonight, that because I hear people talking to me sometimes about relapsing, and relapsing is part of their recovery, and I ain't here to say anything about that except to tell you that's not my experience, and it don't have to be that way. I don't see that, for me, relapse is not part of my recovery. Ever since that day to this very day right here, I've been sober. You know, and the book talks about 50% of us that come in and really try hard can have that. And I just want to let you know that you don't have to go back out there. From this day forward, you don't ever have to do that shit ever again if you don't want to. But, you know, I was in the treatment center for 28 days in that hospital, and I ain't going to tell you I heard anything and got all kinds of wisdom. And I didn't hear shit, man. I couldn't even go to a meeting for 3 days. My first day, I crashed. My second day, I couldn't sit in no meeting. I couldn't sit nowhere but the toilet bowl. And the third day, my bowels were a little better. My head was a little less foggy, and I went to my first meeting ever. And it was a meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous. And two women were there, brought a meeting to that place that day. And if I live to be 110, I'll never forget what this one lady said. She said, I'm sure, I'm positive, there's no doubt in my mind, the three most important things I do each morning when I get up is to make my bed, put the cap on the toothpaste, and hit my knees. And I'm going, the hell is she talking about, put the cap on the toothpaste? I'm dying over here. What are you talking about, putting cap on the toothpaste? I'm in the wrong place. And I got up to leave. And I can't tell you how I didn't leave there, except to tell you the angels stopped me. And the best thing that hospital did for me was introduce me to the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the best thing they did for me. I think that's the best thing any treatment center could do for anybody. Introduce you to the fellowship. You know, and I came in. I'm not going to go through all the steps for you, tell you how to work the steps. That's not my job. They wrote a book that tells you how to work the steps. It works pretty good. It's called The Big Book. The counselor would say to me, Danny, you got to do this. And I'd say, why? You know what? I can't ever remember anybody saying to me, you want a drink? Why? Can't ever remember somebody tapping on my window at 3 in the morning talking about, yo, I got this shit, you want some? Well, I'll try. But I never tried to get high. I got high. You know, and so I come in here, he says, read this chapter, we're going to talk about it tomorrow, and I say, I'll try. And they tell him, I'll try nothing, Danny, you just do what we tell you and you'll get well, your life will change. I call it my Houdini analogy. And what I mean by that is, when I was out there, you could have put me in a straitjacket and handcuffed me and wrapped some chains around me and padlock it and fold me over and put me in a box and wrap some chains around the box and padlock it and kick it off into the water and watch me get a hit. I'll get out of all that shit and I'll give me some dope, yet I come in the rooms and I can't read a chapter without talking about I'll try. I can't come to the meeting a half an hour early and help with the coffee or something. You know, I can't. I start talking about I'll try. And I didn't try to get high. You know, in the second sentence, for those of you that are new in how it works that we read all the time, it tells me who's going to get sober, who's not going to get sober, and why. It says those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Completely. I don't know about you, but I completely gave myself to that process out there.
And anytime I'm wondering if I'm half-stepping here, I just ask myself, if it were for some dope, would I be doing this? And I say, yeah, then I better do it here in recovery. You know? And so that's what helped me in step one. In step two, you know, I'm not stupid. I didn't come here to find God. And I know you said higher power in step two, but I know you were talking about God. You can't fool me. And I didn't want nothing to do with God. I did not come here to find God. God died for me when I was 10 years old. My father was God. And I didn't want nothing to do with God. And you people started talking about God, and I said, no thanks. A guy said to me one night, what are you afraid of, Danny? God ain't going to do no worse for you than the dope man did. And a guy pulled me aside one night. At that time, I had two daughters, and he said to me, Danny, if your oldest daughter became a prostitute, would you hate her? And I said, no, I wouldn't hate my daughter. He said, if your other daughter became a junkie, who's hitting all ladies upside the head, taking a pocketbook, would you hate her? I said, no, I wouldn't hate my daughter. He said, do you believe in God? I said, sure, you know, I'm a recovering Catholic too. So I always knew there was a God. I just figured it had nothing to do with me. So I guess that's agnostic, right? So I said, yeah, there's a God. And he said, well, let me see if I could run this back to you if I got it right. You can love your children, no matter what they do, you can love your children, and you know there's a God, but you don't think that God has the capacity to love you in spite of what you've done. It's mighty big of you, Danny. And so for the first time in my life, I had to take another look at this thing that I called God. And I shared with you already, and I'll share with you again. Today I know God loves me just as I am. Whether I'm in the dope house getting high, or I'm working one-on-one with an addict, or I'm standing here sharing with you, regardless of what I'm doing, my God loves me. And there's a lot of peace in that. Do I love my God back? Depends on how I act. And that's important. And the third step, and I think Darnell talked about it in his workshop today, you know, that saying, there was this saying going around the room, let go and let God, give it to God. And I love that saying. I'm a dope fiend, and I'll use and misuse that saying. And I can remember real early in my sobriety, I had this problem. It was a huge problem. I don't remember what it was anymore, but it was a huge problem. I went to my sponsor, and I shared it with my sponsor, and he said, wow, what are you going to do about that? I said, give it to God. And he said, okay, Danny. And about a week later, I still got this huge problem, same problem. And I went back to my sponsor. I said, what's up with this? I gave this to God last week. He said, Danny, God don't want that shit. He said, maybe there's some work you got to do here. You see, there's nothing in step three that relieves me of the responsibility of taking action. I thought, I'll give it to God. You know what I learned? God don't got to do the third step. God don't got to do any of these steps. But I do. There's work I got to do. There's a word, a little four-letter word that I kept missing in step three, and it's care, C-A-R-E, the care of God. That, you know what that means to me today? I understand that. I do the best I can with whatever's in front of me. I check my motives. I do the best that I can, and I leave the results of that to the care of God. God is in the result business, not Danny anymore. When I'm in the result business, I screw stuff up. My life becomes complicated. I get into fear. I get into resentments. I get into jealousies and anxieties and all kinds of negative things when I'm trying to make results. When I can just go ahead and do the next right thing in front of me, my life is so much easier, you know? And I want to tell you, what happened was, 18 months sober, I moved. How am I doing, Margaret? Thank you. I'm getting there, baby. 18 months sober, I had, I tend to talk a lot, so she warned me before the meeting to get on time. 18 months sober, I moved to Oklahoma City. Old Army buddy of mine. Anyway, 2 years sober, I flew back to New York to celebrate my 2-year birthday, get my cake and my medallion, and I did. I got my medallion, and the next day, for those of you that are familiar with New York, Alan, of course, In Manhattan, the sidewalks are big, and there's always somebody selling stuff on the sidewalk. Well, I got my daughters, and they're running in and out of the stores, and they're shopping, and I'm standing outside. I'm about four stores down the block, and all of a sudden, I was hit with this overwhelming urge to get high that I hadn't faced anything like it in my 2 years. And I counted my money, and I said, when the kids come out of the store, I'm going to tell them I don't feel good. I'm taking them home, and I'm going to get some dope. And then I remembered reading the book that it said that there's going to be a time in all our lives that we're going to be hit with a desire to use that no human power could do anything about, but God could. And I remembered reading that, and so I looked up and I said, God, please help me, because I really don't want to use as much as I want to use. And then I looked down the street, and on the corner, this guy had this stand set up where he can show both sides of it. And he had all these wooden plaques, and they were all a picture of an animal, and it was shellacked. And they were all, and I was like four stores up the block. But right in the middle of them, there was this one that was writing, and it caught my eye, and I was just kind of drawn to it, and I walked to it. And I'm going to read it for you, because whenever I get a chance to share, I read this because it saved my life. And my mind at that time was that I was getting ready to use. And I walked up to this thing, and in big print it said, the letter. And it said, dear friend, how are you? I just had to send a note to tell you how much I care about you. I saw you yesterday as you were talking with your friends. I waited all day hoping you would want to talk with me too. I gave you a sunset to close your day and a cool breeze to rest you. And I waited. You never came. It hurt me, but I still love you because I am your friend. I saw you sleeping last night and longed to touch your brow, so I spilled moonlight upon your face. Again, I waited, wanting to rush down so we could talk. I have so many gifts for you. You awoke and rushed off to work. My tears were in the rain. If you would only listen to me, I love you. I try to tell you in blue skies and in the quiet green grass. I whisper it in leaves on the trees and breathe it in colors of flowers. Shout it to you in mountain streams and give the birds love songs to sing. I clothe you with warm sunshine and perfume the air with nature's scents. My love for you is deeper than the ocean and bigger than the biggest need in your heart. Ask me. Talk with me. Please don't forget me. I have so much to share with you. I won't hassle you any further. It is your decision. I have chosen you, and I will wait. I love you, your friend, Jesus. And I bought that. My kids came out of the store, and I had this plaque, and they said, what's that, Dad? And I said, just a little something I needed today, because I was out of it, man. I was out of it. And I want to tell you, my experience to this day, I've never found anything like that again. And I kind of believe that, you know, when I'm doing all that I can, when I'm doing what's humanly possible for me, then and only then will God come in and do for me what I can't do for myself. And that's been my experience in this program more than one occasion. That was a big one right there. A big one. Because I was ready to get high. And I think that if I wasn't doing the things I was supposed to do, that I probably had a lesson coming that I wouldn't have liked too much. But that wasn't the case. And I took the first thing smoking out of town, man. I left the next day and I came back to Oklahoma. And one month after that, I was indicted by the federal government, Southern District of New York, for wreckage of my past. And I had to fly back to New York and surrender myself to the feds, over 2 years sober. And when I surrendered myself and they put me in the cell and bail was being arranged to me, I knew I had changed. I knew that the roots of Cocaine Anonymous had taken hold into this sorry sot, and that I had changed. Because for the first time ever in my life, and I've been getting locked up all my life, I was in a cell and I felt uncomfortable. And I never felt uncomfortable. So just give me a cigarette, something to read, and let me out when you let me out. And I knew bail was being arranged and I felt like I didn't belong there. And my lawyer said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, let's plead guilty to this. And he said, Danny, I got to tell you, you're a three-time loser. It's only a 10-year charge, but this is the federal government. They could go outside the guidelines and give you life with no parole. And I said, I'll call you back tomorrow. And I did what you people taught me to do. I talked about it. I wrote about it. I prayed about it. And I called my lawyer back. I said, plead guilty. And then something happened. The judge on my case died. And they appointed a brand new federal judge, and I don't know if you're familiar with the way it works, but a federal judge is for life. And the first case this brand new judge was hearing was my case. And I had gotten away with lots and lots of things over the years that I've been arrested for, charged with, and beat. Either charges were dropped or beat in court. And my lawyer's telling me, this is not good, Danny. We got to get a postponement and try to get it away from this guy. And I said, nah, just go ahead with the case. And I flew back to New York and I got a pre-sentence report done. And the probation officer recommended 7 years. That was good. It was a 10-year charge. And I went back and people from all over the place wrote letters for me and sent them to the judge. One lady even called the judge up. And people were faxing the judge letters. And a guy said to me, don't worry about nothing, Danny, because no matter what the judge wants to do, when he gets ready to sentence you, the angels are going to touch him, and you'll be okay. And I said, cool. And then a guy in an AA meeting says to me one day, maybe God wants you to carry the message behind the wall in prison. And I said, leave it to these drunks to screw stuff up. And I was in fear in 1 second and a lot of faith the next second and back and forth. And people say you can't have fear and faith at the same time. I don't know where they've been, but I had it. Fear, faith. And I went in front of the judge and he told me to stand up. And I stood up and my legs were shaking. And he says to me, you got anything to say? And I said, the only thing I could tell you, Your Honor, is that paper in front of you was me and I did that. But the person in front of you was somebody different today. I didn't know what else to say to him. And he held up a stack of papers about that thick. And he said, I got all of these letters on you. They're very impressive. I want you to know I read them all. I also want you to know that I got somebody like you in my courtroom, and 7 years is a joke. And you're not getting anything like 7 years in this court. And I knew I was dead. I knew this guy was going to send me away for a long time. And as he went to bang his thing down, he shook his head and he went just like this. He said, and I don't know why I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And he gave me a 5-year suspended sentence and a fine, a very large fine. He gave me a humongous fine. He like broke me with the fine, but but I was free and I went, yeah, and my lawyer went, yeah, and then the judge like snapped out. He's like, what the hell did I just do? And locked that guy up till he pays X amount of dollars. Now I'm not telling you that if you're new in this program, I'm not telling you that if you gotta go to court, if you're sober, that you ain't gonna go away. Maybe God wants you to carry the message behind the wall. But I can tell you that God didn't want me to do that. Because I saw the angels touch that man right in front of my eyes. I saw it. And I know why I'm sober today. Because I got some payback to do and I got some work to do for God. I understand that. And the reason I'm sober today ain't because I'm a nice guy. It ain't because I'm none of this, all of that, or a bag of chips, any of that shit. I'm sober today because I have the ability to help somebody else. And woe is me if I ever forget that. And I like to tell you, if you be sober tonight and you're not reaching your hand out to help somebody, shame on you, because you ain't all that either. And I know why you're sober too. And you're sober because you have the ability. See, everybody in this room, I said that before. Not everybody likes Danny. Not everybody wants to hear what Danny's got to say. But everybody in this room, there's somebody that only what you have to say. Only what you have to say is going to help somebody somewhere down the road. And how dare you be sober and tap into these powers in these rooms and not give that and be available to that person when it's time to save their life and help them. That's what this is about. This program is about bringing hope to the hopeless. That's what we do. How do we bring hope to the hopeless? We stand up here and we share what it was like for us. We share our pain, our insanity. We share what happened and we share our glory and our blessings. And we suit up and we show up and we be available for the next person. That's what we do. That's the beauty of this program. And I just want to share with a couple of miracles for you real quick before I shut up. You know, after that thing, you're looking at somebody that never went to the seventh grade in school. Never went. I was too busy running the streets. I didn't have a job until I was 2 years sober when I got a job for this court thing that I was just telling you about. Okay? That was my first job ever in my life. I just stole all my life. That's what I did. But I went to the sixth grade. I never went back to school. I got sober. I got my GED. I had to get my driver's license. Got my driver's license when I was 16. Lost it when I was 17. I was 32 or 33 when I got sober. I went back to get it. They're like, who the hell are you? No. You know? I got a GED. I started taking classes in school. About 2 or 3 years ago, I got a master's degree. I mean, that's what... I share that with you to share with you some of the blessings, you know? I mean, I don't use my master's degree, but it looks good on my wall. You know? It looks really nice. It's mine. I did that, you know? I've been a felon ever since I've been 12, 13 years old. Never had the right to vote. Never cared about that, but never had the right to vote. 3 years ago, when I finished all my paper and everything, all my rights were restored back to me. I registered and I voted. I was dying to see what it was like in there, you know, when there was no more boots or nothing. When I thought it was a boot with the curtain. There was none of that. You just went in and did. But I did it. I voted, you know. I got a passport a few years ago. Went to London with my friend Susan over there. They gave me a passport in my name. My name. Somebody we were talking to the other day said, I got five of them. Yeah, but it weren't in his name. Who was that? It was one of you guys there. You, yeah, there you go. I had five of them too, but they went, this one was in my name. You know, I don't have enough time to stand up here tonight and tell you about all the blessings in my life, all the miracles in my life. You know, I just could tell you, there's three things that I'm positive. There's no doubt in my mind, the three most important things that I do each morning when I get up is to make my bed, put the cap on the toothpaste, and hit my knees. Thanks for letting me share.